This is CliffCentral.com.
Welcome back to Brain and Brands, helping you unleash the power of your brain and your brand. I am Timothy Maurice, and on the phone with me, we have Dr. Tara Swart. She is an MIT professor, neuroscientist, medical doctor, who is the founder of The Unlimited Mind and author of Neuroscience for Leadership. Dr. Swart, welcome to Brain and Brands.
Thanks for having me back.
So today we're going to focus on how neuroscience and health and how it can help a leader or an influencer or anyone who is sort of in a high-pressure environment who is looking to create an edge and to sustain their creative edge and their, you know, sort of health in a way that promotes them. Today's show is really dedicated to them.
Our brain and our body are constantly affecting each other. This seems obvious in a way, but most of the people I see who are the leaders and the influencers, they don't live in the way that shows that they're really understanding the effect of your brain on your body and vice versa. So, you know, just things like if you're cold, if you're hungry, if you're tired, if you're jet lagged, that affects the way that you think. And of course, that affects your ability as a leader. And equally, if you're really stressed or even if you're feeling like overconfident or just very confident, that changes the nerves and hormones activity in your body.
Wow.
Yeah, so understanding that from the beginning, I think, is really important. And then let's take that a little bit further, because I really like to talk about physical, mental, emotional, and spiritual health or wealth. Now, all four of those categories affect each other. So if you're, you know, if you're physically fit and healthy, if you're thinking really well, and you know, you're part of a community or a faith or something, so spiritually you feel like you're, you know, in integrity with your values. But emotionally, let's say you're feeling stressed or lonely or bullied or whatever it is, that will come out in one of the other areas. If you suppress it, you'll end up becoming physically ill, or you'll end up isolating yourself, or your thinking will become very negative. So all four of those really affect each other, and you have to make sure that, you know, you're looking at all four categories. So it's about holistic or integrated well-being.
Got it. I just want to make sure that the listener is clear that what we're about to give you is pretty special. You teach these things, and people pay a lot of money to hear some of the things you're going to share. Am I right?
That's true. And actually, that's one of the reasons that I really wanted to work with you, and previously that I really wanted to write the book, because I started thinking, this can change everybody's life. This can make everybody's life a little bit better. And what I say to the people that, you know, come to my classes or my workshops or get individual coaching from me is, don't change one thing by 10%. Change 10 things by 1% and you'll get a much bigger overall benefit.
Wow.
And then, of course, they can hear directly from me, what are those 5, 7, 10 things that you could change? And I sort of thought, you know, unless you're getting coaching or you're coming to these talks, it felt wrong that you shouldn't have access to this information. That's why I wrote the book.
Wonderful.
But, you know, with you, I feel like there's an even greater reach to different types of people, but with the same information.
Absolutely. And can I say this? This is fascinating, because as you're speaking, I'm thinking back to my early days growing up in, you know, a very sort of religious home, and thinking about my parents eating after praying really hard and, you know, eating fried chicken. And it never made sense to me. Like, in my mind, I'm thinking, you just did all of that praying, but now you're about to kill yourself. So I'm like, this is very important. And I really want people to stress, as you go through your 7 tips, and these 7 tips are not really tips. They are more than tips. They are inspired ideas that have deep sort of research and sort of sound sort of backing and case studies and history behind them. So I really want everyone to appreciate the fact that, you know, this holistic look at your identity is absolutely critical. I know for a fact that when I started running, I went from writing about 600,000 words a year to about 900,000 words a year. So this is very, very real and very applicable to everybody. And I've experienced it myself, and it completely, completely changed my life. So I'm excited about hearing all of these tips.
And I think, you know, one of the things is, it's so difficult to stay well informed. There's so much information out there. Some of it's conflicting. A lot of it looks like it's based on science. How do you unpick that and know what you should be doing for yourself and for your children? You know, good people with positive intentions might be feeding their children food that's not helping their brain to grow, just like you said. So let's go through the first three of the tips. They're very physical. Okay. One of them is nutrition, but I'd like to start with the one that I think is the most important. So the reason I put them in this order is because I thought, how long would it take you to die if you didn't do this thing? How it works out, how important they are. So Actually, the first three are sleep, nutrition, and hydration.
Okay.
And we still don't really know why we spend so much of our lives sleeping, but we know that it's absolutely vital to our health and our well-being. And, you know, enough disrupted sleep and you start to not be able to function as a human, and eventually you wouldn't be able to continue your life. So there's a couple of things about sleep, one short-term and one long-term. So if you have had disrupted sleep last night, then today you would be operating at work or in life with an apparent IQ loss of 5 to 8 points.
Oh, wow.
Now, most people listening to this podlet would be able to do the day job, even though they're 5 to 8 IQ points less than they normally are. But that's after one night's sleep. After 4 or 5 nights of bad sleep, you start to accumulate what we call sleep debt. And then you can't actually catch that up by sort of, you know, oversleeping at the weekend. So you start to get more permanent effects of disrupting your sleep. And, I mean, these are all based on population norm studies. So it's not going to be correct for every single individual. But these statistical studies show that if you lose a whole night's sleep, then that group of people, that IQ drops by one standard deviation, which would take anyone with even a high IQ to below normal IQ. And, you know that I travel a lot. I come to South Africa. I'm in the States at the moment, but I live in the UK. And when I'm really jet lagged, I literally can't deal with details, can't deal with numbers. I forget if I've replied to emails or not. You know, it's actually quite scary. And I almost class jet lag as a mental illness because your brain isn't functioning normally.
Wow. And let me ask you this. This is fascinating because if there are people who probably think there's something wrong with their mind because they can't remember things, et cetera, they may think they are dealing with sort of early dementia, and it could actually be sleep deprivation.
Yeah, I mean, in the short term, it could be. It could be stress. So stress literally kills off neurons, particularly in the memory part of our brain.
Okay.
But it's interesting that you picked up on dementia, because the second thing that I was going to say about sleep is the longer term effects of regularly not getting enough sleep. And there is scientific research that now shows a causal link between that and dementing diseases like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. So.
Oh, wow.
I know. What we believe is that the reason we have to sleep for 7 to 9 hours, so most human brains, like 98-99% of human brains, need to sleep for 7 to 9 hours a night, is because this very specialized cleansing process of the brain takes 7 or 8 hours. So you need to be lying down in bed, preferably on your side, to allow this lymphatic clearage of toxins from your brain. So there's a fluid system, I call it like the aqueduct system of the brain. And we used to think that fluid passively trickled through the brain for 7 or 8 hours, but actually it's like a forcible flushing of toxins out of your brain. And if that process is disrupted, then we see a buildup of things like protein plaques and beta amyloid tangles. And these are the pathology of things like Alzheimer's and other dementias. When I was writing my book, they knew, you know, the science was saying that disrupted sleep over a long period of time is connected to that, but we can't say if it's the cause. But now the research has moved in the direction to say that it does cause those sorts of diseases to be more likely.
So for a 21-year-old student who crams and spends, you know, the bulk of their student life having their sleep disrupted because of studying and working, et cetera, are they shielded from it because of their youth, their vitality? Is this more of a conversation for us older people?
We've only come across this information very recently. But if I had known this 20 years ago, would I have done something differently? I mean, it's hard to say because you're studying hard, you're partying hard, your priorities are different. But the soonest in your life that you know how important it is to get regular, undisrupted sleep, I would focus on making that happen. So I was a junior doctor in my 20s. I did shift work. I had lots of disrupted sleep. I still travel a lot. But whenever I can control it, I try to make sure that I get 8 hours of good quality sleep.
Got it. And disrupted sleep, if I wake up once in the middle of the night urinate or whatever, is that considered disruptive? What is disruptive sleep?
Yeah, so I think there's two answers to that. So one is very, sort of personal. If you feel like, oh, no, I woke up because I had to go to the loo and now my sleep's ruined and it will take me hours to get back to sleep, then that's disruption. But if you just go to the bathroom, get back to bed, fall asleep again, that's not disruption. And I use a wearable technology to monitor my sleep from time to time. And I use it on my clients as well. It's a heart rate variability technology. And even when I'm jet lagged, occasionally when I wake up suddenly and then I fall back asleep again, it didn't show up as serious disruption. So it's pretty, it depends on you. It depends on the reason. But if you switch all the lights on and start reading or watching TV or looking at screens with blue light, then you've disrupted your sleep. If you keep things dark, go back and lie down, maybe do some kind of, relaxation practice, then it shouldn't be counted as disruptive.
My last question is, when it comes to sleepwalkers, this is my first time admitting it publicly, but I sleepwalk. My first time sleepwalking was when I was 14 years old. I found myself outside in the snow after getting my baseball glove from my father's car, and I locked myself out, and I woke up when I realized how cold it was. And my father explained to me that I was sleepwalking. And I still have moments where I sleepwalk, and it's quite frightening. If I'm sleeping and walking, I'm still sleeping, right?
Yeah, so we believe that people who sleepwalk or who talk in their sleep are asleep. It's more to do with the... So you're supposed to be almost in a state of paralysis when you're in some stages of sleep. And it's more to do with that not being switched on, so you're able to move around. But we actually don't know that much about it. But as far as we know, you are actually still very much asleep. And people have to be careful about how they wake somebody up when they're walking around if it's sleepwalking.
I just imagine somebody waking me up as I'm walking around.
Yeah.
Okay. So, sorry. I just wanted just to sort of make sure that people are clear what disruptive sleep is. And if there are any sleepwalkers like myself, then they understand that. What's happening.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So the one I want to talk about next is nutrition.
Before you go to nutrition, I apologize. I just want to make sure people are clear that this 5 to 8 points you lose in IQ if you continue in sleep deprivation has very real consequences. There are very specific things you won't be able to do at the level by losing these 5 to 8 points. Am I right?
Well, the 5 to 8 points is just after one night of disrupted sleep. And it's, your IQ doesn't change, but it's what you can do with it that changes. So it's just, I think 5 to 8 points isn't really enough that it would make a noticeable difference to most people. But it's when you do that for 4 or 5 nights in a row that it comes to the point where it's the same as coming into work and saying, I'm absolutely drunk.
Okay, so Monday, you start the week off. Mm-hmm. And you're having disrupted sleep Monday through Thursday. On that Friday, you're close to drunk.
It's probably equivalent. There are studies that show it's the equivalent to certain levels of alcohol intoxication in terms of your mental function, yeah.
Okay, awesome. Thank you. Point number two, nutrition.
Okay, so I call it refueling, almost like an athlete. And the thing about sleep is that, our sort of... national rugby teams and football teams, when they travel to compete, they know that there are some guys that can train the next day and some that have to rest for a day and then train. So we need to think about ourselves like that, both in terms of sleep and refueling or nutrition. Because our brain only weighs 2 to 3% of our whole body weight, but it's a very energy-hungry organ. Even when you're just at rest, like just, you know, not working too hard, it uses up 20% of the breakdown products of a healthy, balanced diet. When you're focusing or concentrating or thinking really hard or, you know, doing something a bit more demanding, like regulating your emotions, thinking flexibly or creatively, then it's using up to 30% of what you eat. So wow. When you sat down for a meal, if you thought a quarter to a third of this is going to affect my thinking, not my physical body, what might you do differently?
Mm. Wow.
Yeah. So there are some obvious things that come from that, which is eat regularly. So your brain can't store the breakdown products of your diet. So the breakdown products are glucose in a medical sense, but that doesn't mean refined sugar. So we don't want people to think that eating cookies or drinking sodas is a way of giving, you know, resources to your brain. It's about eating healthily and regularly so that your brain has a good supply of what it needs when it needs it.
Okay.
So, for instance, I would never go to a coaching session with a client without eating something first. I feel like this person is paying me to use my brain to help them. So I have to, I'm responsible for, you know, sort of walking there, getting a bit of oxygen going around my brain and body, and having a snack if I haven't had a meal within in the last 1.5 hours. And we'll come on to hydration. So obviously also making sure that I've had enough water to drink. So it's about eating enough, eating regularly, and eating the right food. So most people have a fairly good idea of what a healthy, you know, balanced diet is, but there are some particularly my favorite brain-friendly foods.
Okay.
Salmon and other oily fish, eggs, avocado, nuts and seeds, and then just all the water-rich and oil-rich foods like vegetables, fruit, olives. And then there's one that's the absolute rocket fuel for your brain, which is coconut oil.
Oh, wow. Why is this coconut oil so effective?
Coconut oil has what's called medium-chain triglycerides, which are a form of fuel. So it's a vegetable fat which provides fuel that the brain can take up directly without it having to be broken down by the liver. And there's a study from Duke University in the States that shows that if you eat 1 teaspoonful of coconut oil, then your cognitive function, so your ability to think, improves for 20 minutes afterwards. So I just melt a spoonful of coconut oil into my cup of tea in the morning.
Oh. Mm. Did you do that this morning? Because you sound sharp.
I didn't, because I'm traveling. I didn't bring a tub of coconut oil with me, so I'm looking forward to going home.
Okay, great. Have
you heard about bulletproof coffee?
No, I haven't.
It's a particularly clean version of coffee that you drink with butter and coconut oil in it.
Really?
Yeah, look it up. But the butter is like a fat that buffers the effect of the caffeine, so it lasts for longer, but the coconut oil is literally like rocket fuel for your brain.
I'm definitely looking that up. So you basically saying just take a Google. Is there a specific brand or a website that we can go
to?
Yeah,
Bulletproof Coffee is the brand. Okay. But in the UK, I co-designed a juice with a juice company, and we made it a more sort of natural, healthy version of that, which is with matcha green tea, cashew nut milk, coconut oil, chia seeds, and cucumber water. So it's sort of the same idea, you know, that there's caffeine, but it's buffered by a fatty substance. This was a nut milk, and then it's also got the coconut oil in it. So you could make, you know, people could make a version of this at home.
Wow. And I, you know, one of the things that I'm fascinated by is how culture and social dynamics impact diet. I'm imagining there are people listening going, look, we got a long weekend coming up, and we're going to be brining a lot, and there's not going to be any salmon, there's not going to be any nuts and seeds, certainly no coconut oil. And bulletproof coffee is probably quite a distance away. So, you know, how do you enjoy a very sort of, you know, traditionally socially rich life? And you receive some of these health benefits. And I know, for example, I do speak a lot about sacrifice and preparation and making sure that you do incorporate these things. But is there a way for the average sort of oak in South Africa to be able to enjoy a braai with the boys without being looked at as some weirdo?
Yeah, so look, I think it's about everything in moderation. So when you're socializing, just, you know, go ahead and enjoy that braai and all the bad oil that it's cooked in. No, I'm joking. Yeah, so, you know, the importance of positive social relationships is huge as well. Our sense of belonging is huge. Our need for belonging is huge. So absolutely enjoy that. When you're on your own and when you've got more choice and control of what you can eat, just try to eat as many of the brain-friendly foods as possible.
Got it.
So, you know, if I go out for a meal, I'm in New York at the moment. If I go out to a nice restaurant, I'll try to probably pick a salmon and something else. But, you know, I'll just enjoy myself. But at other times, when I can, I'll drink a green juice. I'll, you know, sort of make sure I'm getting enough fruit and vegetables and things like that. Now, you've asked about something, having had South African culture as a big part of my life, I totally understand that. But that's still a choice. I'm more concerned about the people who have to eat certain foods because they don't have choice, whether that's poverty or whether it's just tradition. And so I've been asked about this before. Actually, I was in the UK, but I was working with a South African company, and somebody said, you know, what about the fact that in Southern Africa, a lot of people eat corn-based starch? What can we do about that? And, you know, they may not have access to fish or seafood. And the way that I've managed to sort of reconcile that in my heart, because I, you know, it does seem unfair, is that we have adapted to get what we need out of the food that's available locally. You know, we're moving back to eating local, seasonal, sustainable food. So I think if you're in an area that's, you know, inland, or there is just a lot of corn or wheat available, then somehow you'll be getting the nutrients that you need. But whatever you can do to expose yourself to better nutrients, obviously that's going to be better for you.
Sure. And I think this is where partnerships and alliances, where there are organizations who are specifically designed to provide foods, can think differently, because if they have the choice, then they can help communities have a choice as well.
Absolutely.
Awesome. So any further point, any other brain sort of power foods before we move to hydration?
Well, you know, I actually strongly believe that water, so the healthy fats and water are kind of what the brain is actually made of. So that's why it needs those sort of substances to keep itself at peak health. And so, yeah, I'd like to actually move on to hydration, which I consider to be part of refueling yourself. And, you know, the last time I was in South Africa, when I saw you, there was this just horrifying situation of not having enough water in parts of the country. And the things that people were doing to move water around the country was just so heartwarming. And I think I saw South Africa at its worst and South Africa at its best in the same day.
Yes.
And as we know, we literally cannot live without water. Can't live for very long. So water is very, very important for ourselves. Just as you would think about, I was so upset when I heard that healthy cattle were being slaughtered because they wouldn't be able to give them enough water.
Yes.
But it's kind of the same for us. You know, we also can't function if we don't get enough water. So as a scientist, when I look at somebody and they look dehydrated, you know, and I can see the little fine lines on their face, or they've got a really dry mouth or cracked lips, I kind of think, I can see, it's almost like I can x-ray through your skull and see that the neurons in your brain, they can't send each other the chemical and electrical messages that they need to, like, you know, pass information around pathways in your brain. And that's why I find it so frustrating when I have, you know, people who drink lots of coffee and then maybe have a few beers in the evening, but they can't drink enough water. I don't accept that. So I'm a big advocate of drinking enough water, especially if you do drink a lot of coffee or alcohol.
Yes, I found myself, I drink far too much coffee and not enough water, and I've seen the impact, and I've tried to figure out a way to incorporate by keeping bottles in my car, you know, and just making a conscious effort to get water at a restaurant, etc. But mm-hmm. I still feel like I'm not getting enough. How much is enough?
You need to drink about half a liter for every 15 kilos of your body weight. So you should probably be drinking like 2.5-3 liters a day. I made
2.5-3 liters. Wow. Okay. How do you suppose I go about doing that?
You run, so you need to drink more. And if you drink coffee, you need to drink more.
Okay, so let me tell you what happened to me today so that you can help advise people who are going through my lifestyle. So this morning I ran 8 kilometers,
mm-hmm.
and I've had 2 espressos, and mm-hmm. I've had 1 glass of water.
Oh, Timothy. This is, I mean.
Am I about
to
die?
This is where I get a bit directive. Okay, so here's your example of when I said, you know, this is why I say I'm a consultant, not a coach. If you exercise like that and you do not refuel properly with protein and rehydrate afterwards, you are damaging your body.
Okay. Which part am I damaging?
Well, the muscle repair that needs to happen after exercising like that, you're not giving it the resources that it needs to do that.
Okay.
And by being dehydrated, you're damaging your ability to use your brain properly.
That explains a lot.
You know, that's what the shortcut is. So basically, you've given yourself brain damage this morning, and then at your sort of lowest level of thinking, you're like, oh, I don't feel so good. Let me have another coffee. Mm, do you see what I mean? Geez. It's like a vicious circle.
Okay. When we finish this pilot, I'm going to go get water before we move on to the next one. Thank you very much.
Good.
Okay. Other ways to hydrate ourselves, you say there's water and so forth in certain vegetables, there's water in meats, there's water, you know, but you need to drink more water. One of the things that I have been struggling with is I really enjoy sort of sparkling water, what they call it here. I think it's called different things in different parts of the world, but here it's called sparkling water. Somehow I feel that there is a fundamental difference. If I drink 2 liters of sparkling water a day versus normal still water. Is there a difference? I can't find anything online. Help me.
Yeah, there is. So the carbonation process lowers the pH of the water. So, you know, 7 is neutral. If you start looking at the pH of all the water that you buy.
Okay.
Carbonated water is always less than 7, so it's basically acidic.
Oh.
Wow. Which is not very good for you. No. So, it's not as hydrating as still water. You have to retrain your taste buds, Timothy.
I see. And what's really valuable about this conversation is that I know the majority of the people listening, like myself, good people getting up and, you know, because they don't want to drink carbonated Coca-Colas, et cetera, those type of sodas, they'll drink sparkling water and go, I drank my water for the day. And this is just, as you say, the pH levels and so forth, this is fundamentally not giving them what they need to be able to thrive. And this is particularly why I wanted to do this pilot series, is to really break down, get to the core. Because, you know, well-meaning people who Google and try to find the answer, Dr. Google is not always right, because we are controlling Dr. Google. And I think this is so, so, so valuable. Is there any other hydration tips before we close this pilot?
There's quite a new movement towards saying that you should actually be eating your water. So eating, you know, the lettuces, the fruits, the green leafy vegetables. You get water, a cucumber particularly, you get a lot of water from eating those. But I also think, you know, your skin is your largest organ. So being quite mindful about how much water you are potentially losing through your skin. So especially in South Africa, staying in the shade when you can, moisturizing your skin with, you know, even if it's with something very natural like olive oil, this it presents a bit of a more of a barrier to losing hydration, especially in hot countries. But mostly this feeling when we wake up and we're a bit groggy and we think, oh, I need a coffee. The first thing to do is to drink a large glass of water and you won't feel groggy anymore. That's because you've been dehydrated overnight. Mm-hmm. So really making water your friend. And all I say to people is just try it. Just slowly increase your water intake over 2 weeks. I guarantee you will not go back because you will actually feel the difference.
Wow. Appreciate that.
The fourth tip is one that you're doing very well already, and because it's exercise.
Thank you. Finally, I'm doing something right.
So cardiovascular exercise, it provides oxygen to our brain. It probably helps with fending off the aging process over time in terms of your cognitive ability. But there's something really fascinating from the neuroscience about exercise, which isn't the usual, you know, do exercise, it's healthy. It matters very much from a brain point of view how much you enjoy the exercise that you're doing. So ideally, we would live like we did, you know, when we were cave people. We would move around for several hours during the day and maybe have some rest time, but we would be kind of walking around quite a lot during the day. So a lot of people now use wearable technology to make sure they're getting their 10,000 steps a day. But so many people are in sedentary office jobs where they just sit down all day and they're in meetings or, you know, they don't really move around. So in that case, if you can't move around during the day, then going to the gym a few times a week before or after work makes, you know, makes up that difference as much as possible.
Okay.
But if you're dragging yourself to the gym, you know, to run on the treadmill or something just because you think it's good for you and you get your steps and you get a bit of oxygenation, think again. So in an experiment on rats where they showed the difference between voluntary and involuntary exercise, they showed that there were three groups of rats, one that were kept in a confined space, couldn't exercise, one that were forced to run on a treadmill for a certain number of minutes or hours per day, and the last group were allowed to walk around, do exercise when they wanted to, for as long as they wanted to. So the two groups that did get aerobic exercise both got the benefits of oxygenation in the brain, but only the group that did exercise it wanted to released a growth factor in the brain called BDNF, or brain-derived neurotrophic factor. And neurotrophic means growth of neurons. So this is potentially about connecting up neurons that are already existing. So that can sometimes lead to creative thinking. It sounds like you get that when you exercise.
Yes.
But even more than that, this is about growing these little baby neurons into new neurons. So you're actually growing your brain by doing this exercise. So I encourage people to find something that they really like, whether it's, you know, a team sport or whether it's a dance class, rather than just doing exercise for the sake of it.
So,
and, you know, I actually think that has implications for what work you choose to do, what activities you choose to do, because there does seem to be this differential in the brain between activities that you desire and activities that you feel forced to do.
So for those people who getting on the treadmill is like an absolute pain and they hate it with everything in them, they are cutting off this sort of BDNF.
Yeah, you know, my feeling is that, so you wouldn't be getting BDNF. You're getting some oxygen, obviously, because you're exerting yourself. But if it's that stressful, you have to wonder about how good it is for you mentally.
Got it.
So it's really important to try to find something that you enjoy, and that might mean experimenting with things that you wouldn't have necessarily tried, like a spin class or, you know, just whatever appeals to different people.
I'm with you completely. I found that for me, I love basketball to a point where at my age, there are times where I probably shouldn't be playing it. It's like when President Obama stopped playing it because someone hit him in the eye and he had a major press conference the next day. You can't be a president, you know, with like a black eye because of basketball. And I realized that because I do so much TV and public appearances that, you know, I have to be very strategic, but I love it so much that I'm willing to even take the risk. And I've also realized that because I only have a couple more years left, I think it gives me an added boost or an added level of something, BDNF or whatever, because I genuinely, when I finish playing and I go and I write my articles and my columns, and I just feel different from when I don't get a chance to play. So thank you for confirming why. That's very important.
Sounds great. I think you do need to challenge this thinking that you're too old to keep doing it.
Okay. there's got to be a point of a diminishing returns, number one. And number two, you know, if you're 55 playing basketball, I'm not sure. I don't know. Maybe I just need to change the group that I'm playing with. That's the thing. I think that's it. If I find a group of 50-year-olds, I'm sure we can get down.
You're comparing yourself to these 20-year-olds.
Yeah, that's the problem. Okay. Mm. Awesome.
Okay, so actually, the next one is a sort of combination of two things. I put them together. So humor is very good for the brain. So I'm sure you have a laugh when you're playing basketball.
Yes.
We've laughed about you being an old man playing basketball.
Yes.
But really, you know, when we laugh together, we release this bonding hormone, oxytocin, and it just makes everybody feel warm and, you know, trusting, and that's a good thing.
Okay.
But what I really wanted to talk about here is the role of positive, meaningful social relationships, which comes back to something I mentioned in part one of this podlet, which is about our need to belong. So, you know, we've always existed as tribes or clans or social groups, and being excluded from a group like that is very painful for us psychologically. So feeling like we're part of a group, you know, with family and friends, and that we have somebody we can confide in, we have people that we can share jokes with, people that, you know, could turn to us for advice so we feel needed as well. This is so important for our brains that, you know, they're almost saying now that loneliness is up there with smoking or lack of exercise of killing people.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. So making sure that you have enough interaction with people, especially in everything being, you know, online, you know, using technology to interact with people, it is really vital that we make sure we have enough face-to-face time with the people that we love and who love us.
I read, I didn't want to do this, but Steven Pinker's wife, I didn't want to say Steven Pinker's wife because she's such an intellect herself, her book called The Village Effect, and she spoke specifically about this, and I really think that, you know, once I heard that, I have a friend of mine who's always sad, but he never really reaches out to other people with anything other than, you know, social media. And I told him, get out more. And now I'm going to encourage him to listen to this specific podlet.
Oh, great. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, your instincts, Timothy, our human instincts, they're there, but we don't listen to them. So for you, you know, it came from the heart to say, just get out more, see people more. You started doing more exercise, you felt better. So we kind of know what it is that we have to do, but we don't always do it. And that's probably one of our very human flaws. I also think that we're much more likely to go out of our way to care for our friends and family, our children, our pets, than we are for ourselves. And I think that one of the reasons I really wanted to do this series of podlets with you was to get people to thinking about looking after themselves again, not as a selfish thing, but as a way of being a meaningful contributor to society. Because if you don't look after yourself, eventually something horrible might happen to you, and then you can't be there for your friends and family, and you know, you can't do the things that you dreamed of doing. So it is really important to look after yourself and kind of hold yourself accountable to doing the healthy things that we know we need to do. So I'm using a habit tracker at the moment to make sure that I'm sticking to the 7 tips that I'm working on at the moment. And you can actually share your habits with certain friends, so that helps. But to be honest, just tracking your habits is quite a good way of doing it more than you would otherwise. So, you know, I sometimes do things because I think, oh, I want to be able to tick that off on my habit app. So,
so does the habit app send you notifications and so forth?
No, I haven't set it up like that. So I just have to go and log each day what I have or haven't done.
Okay.
And actually, this leads quite nicely on to the next point that I was going to make, which was about simplicity.
Okay, wait. So before we move on to simplicity, let's deal with this, the value of humor for speakers. What has been your experience when you're speaking to an audience? Because essentially, you're building a relationship with the audience. It's not just your ideas and the audience. It's they, you know, find something in you that they enjoy. And I've heard that speakers who present very complex subject matter, if they are more humorous, it's received easier and people remember the content better. Have you found that to be the case or no?
I'm going to hesitate to answer this question because I think that authenticity is really important. Particularly with, you know, someone who's got my qualifications and, you know, my sort of job title at MIT and everything, I think being competent in your knowledge is the most important thing. I feel like I'm lucky if something funny crops up or, you know, I laugh together with the group, then that's great. What I know that there, and going back to what you said about people who aren't qualified to speak or, you know, this reputation amongst coaches and motivational speakers, I think that if you're purposely setting out to say funny things, to me that doesn't ring true, and I don't actually think that makes people bond with you. So I think the best humor is things that happen unplanned.
Okay, got it.
I think being warm and engaging and something funny always happens, you know. I just think, I certainly don't go out there intending to
tell a joke. Okay, awesome. Number six.
Simplicity.
Okay.
So our brain does prefer simplicity, but we are living in an ever-increasingly complex world, so we hardly ever get any time for simplicity. You mentioned Barack Obama, and I have heard that he does this choice reduction regime in the mornings to bring more simplicity into his morning routine. The reason for that is that when we wake up, even if it's after a good quality 8 hours sleep, we have this bucket of brain resources that's going to get used up by every decision that we make during the day.
Okay.
So because Barack Obama has very big, important decisions to make by the time he gets to work, he doesn't want to use up his bucket too much in the morning. So he would wake up at the same time every day, no matter where he is in the world, same gym routine at the same time, same breakfast at the same time, and he chooses from a very narrow repertoire of clothing. I mean, this is the same reason that Mark Zuckerberg wears the same clothes every day. So he's not using up his brain resources on what should I wear.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Personally, I like to use up my brain resources on what should I wear. So that's one thing that I don't change. But, you know, it's one of the reasons that I've got the Habit Tracker app. You know, it just makes it simple. It's there. I just tick yes or no. And then I know if I've done these things.
That's impressive. That's impressive because, you know, if I think about, for example, you know, I've seen people's, they keep the same profile pictures up. And maybe that's why, you know, I've seen people who don't change things often. And maybe intuitively, as you said earlier, that we have this sort of knowledge in our gut that we're not even aware of. And, you know, I don't know, I'm sure you know people like, for example, keep their old Skype profile pics up, even if they're not really. So it makes a lot of sense. So thank you so much for that one as well. Okay.
I can't believe you've used this opportunity to tease me in public.
Yes.
Okay, moving on. No, so basically, choice reduction is one thing that you can do to bring simplicity into your life. I suggest that people do this at stressful times, that you actually, you purposely bring simplicity into your life at stressful times. Obviously, mindfulness techniques like meditation are also a way of giving your brain some simplicity. And I'm a big fan of the digital detox when I'm on vacation. So even my work email, the out of office will say, I'm on a digital detox. I won't read your email for 2 weeks, but I'll reply after that.
Okay.
And people, they respect that now. You know, I think at first people thought it was a bit quirky, but people understand that that's connected to the science. And I think it kind of hopefully even makes people want to try it a little bit themselves. And it is incredible how much time and space you have if you are not looking at emails, text messages, Facebook, Twitter, etc.
Yes, completely, completely agree. It's had so much value in my life. I went 4 months without being on Facebook and Instagram, and it just really invested so much in me.
Wow, well done.
Thank you. You see, these last tips, I've got these last tips. This is the first couple.
I think you're going to like the next one, too.
Okay.
So the next one, it might seem a bit paradoxical because it's kind of the opposite of simplicity. And that's why I particularly said that you should bring simplicity into your routine when you've got a lot of change going and stress going on around you. This seventh and final tip is called cognitive challenge. So that means purposely learning new things or putting yourself in new and different situations where you have to work out how to kind of, you know, get through something. So it's a bit like solving a problem or thinking flexibly about. So, you know, I include travel in that. I think traveling to different countries, hearing different languages, eating different food, that's all very stimulating for your brain. But the two best things you can do for your brain in adulthood to keep it plastic and flexible for as long as possible is learn a new language or learn a musical instrument.
Okay.
So the people who grew up bilingual or multilingual have a bit of an advantage already in terms of the higher functions of the brain, like emotional regulation, solving complex problems, thinking flexibly and creatively. But between the ages of 25 and 65, your brain is still very open to growing and changing and learning. And so to particularly decide I'm going to learn a language that I didn't know before, or I'm going to pick up a musical instrument, gives your brain global benefits. So not just the benefit of knowing a language or being able to play an instrument, but other benefits in your brain as well, just like flexibility and plasticity. Things like crosswords and Sudoku probably aren't attention intense enough to really give you that effect. And if you like doing crosswords, if you find them quite easy and you're good at them, then purposely do something that you don't actually find that easy, because then you're building up new pathways in your brain. So it's about testing and challenging your brain to keep it plastic and flexible for as long as possible.
You know, one of the things I enjoy about sort of learning a new language or, you know, testing myself in an activity such as learning a new musical instrument is that you do feel the burn almost. You feel that you're being challenged. And it's like in my running, I seek out hills. I try to find steep hills. And in Joburg, there are plenty. So I literally often drive to them and I push myself because I want to know where my limits are. And I think that for me, I've seen that the people who fall in love with challenge are those that continue to grow versus those who find themselves stagnated. And that's across various careers. Have you observed this as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, you know, in the last 10 or 20 years, so basically in the time that you and I have been working, you do see that the people that can't deal with change are becoming more and more at a serious disadvantage in this world, which has become so complex. So I think that putting yourself through those tests when you're at your best not only gives you the benefit of, you know, becoming a better runner or becoming, you know, more multilingual, but it also, when life throws a change at you that you weren't expecting, you will be that much better equipped to deal with that change because you've purposely taught your brain how to take on new and different things and challenges.
Wow. And this is something that, you know, you don't need, you know, you don't need to be wealthy to engage and learn a new language. You can download them offline, pick up an instrument. You know, there are people who will give you an instrument if you don't have the money. But, you know, that's one of the things I love about enriching the brain is that you don't have to be, you know, there's no social level that is unique to engage in these specific tips.
No, I mean, you're absolutely right. You can find a person or a way to try to bring these things into your life. I mean, at the very least, the instrument that you have available to you is your voice.
Wow.
So if it's singing, even if it's listening to music, that's been proven to improve your brain. So, yeah, whatever it is that you can do, or get together with a group, swap things, exchange things, you know, even just reading a novel, that also improves those sort of creative connections in your brain. So whatever it is that you can do, you know if you're pushing yourself to challenge your brain.
our goal is to ensure that your brain operates at a sort of an optimal level, that you're able to engage people, relationships, you're able to be your most creative yourself, you're able to thrive as a leader and move forward in a way that you create a better impact in society. And society grows collectively. I really believe fundamentally, like in Japan, there is no word for I. The word translates to I'm a portion of. And if we're going to be a portion of each other, if you're better, I'm better, and we all better, and we thrive together if your brain is better. So we are thrilled to be able to bring you this series of podlets, Brain and Brand, and looking to see how you can grow your own personal brand, how you can impact the brand of your company and the brand of this country or the country that you live in, wherever you are in the world listening. I want to thank Dr. Tara Swart, MIT professor. You can check her out at www.the-unlimited-mind.com. And please go online, find her book, Neuroscience for Leadership. You can find it on our website, or you can just search it on Amazon or Google, or I'm sure they can send it to your local bookstore if you want a hard copy. I'm really thrilled to be able to bring you this. And by the way, I've got a new book coming out called Personal Brand Intelligence that we'll be chatting a bit about in future. And it'd be nice for you to have both of our latest books to be able to compare notes and see and follow the content as we share it in these podlets on Brain and Brand. Thank you so much, Dr. Swart.
Thank you, Timothy.
This is CliffCentral.com.
I patiently waited for you for 9 months. I would sit in my chair and talk about how I longed to meet you. I knew you'd be the most beautiful baby in the world. I was ready for you, but I wasn't ready for this. If you have a child in need of reconstructive surgery, Smile Foundation can help you. Visit www.smilefoundation.co.za or call us on 0861-276-453.
This is CliffCentral.com.
Hello, it's Reanette Leibovitz from SafetyNet, and thank you for joining another Cyber Health feature. Today, on 12th April 2016, Kaspersky Lab has presented a new application for iOS called Ad Cleaner. It's a free extension for Safari that automatically blocks advertising banners, links, and pop-up windows in web pages opened by the user. As mobile users, we all know we are accustomed to fast internet speeds and quick access to information wherever we are. However, sometimes to get to the information we need, we have to spend time weaving our way through the numerous layers of advertising taking up space on the mobile device's screen, which is small enough as it is. And even though we do get value from certain advertising campaigns, it does steal time and distract you. I mean, how many times has it happened that you're looking for something and then 20 minutes later you realize you've gone off in a different direction looking at stuff that you actually don't even need? Kaspersky Ad Cleaner filters the content of websites opened in Safari, removing annoying advertising that prevents you from viewing information properly. And the user can always choose to load the complete page if you choose to see the advertisements. In this way, Ad Cleaner not only makes surfing the web faster and more convenient, but also helps to reduce the amount of traffic and save battery power. So Alexei Chukov, Senior Product Manager at Kaspersky Lab, said that they believe that no detail is too small when it comes to internet security. In their position, or it is their position, that users have the right to choose what to see or not to see online. Filtering advertising with Kaspersky Ad Cleaner helps to avoid accidentally tapping on advertising banners, which can result in following potentially dangerous links or seeing unwanted content. And finally, this helps to protect your privacy, and ad agencies will not be able to track your actions online. And as a mother, I have to say, this is a fantastic tool for me, because sometimes when I browse the internet with my son, it's scary to see the type of ads that come up, and I don't want to expose him to that. So where can you find this app? The application is available in App Store for a limited number of countries. It is available in South Africa and Kenya, in English and in Russian, and supports iOS 9 or higher. This also complements the portfolio of other applications for iOS, which includes Kaspersky SafeKits and many others. So you can look at www.free.kaspersky.com to find more information and to see which other applications there are, and then to try this Kaspersky Lab at Cleaner to see how it goes. And next week, I look forward to share my experience with you using the stylish Huawei Band. It's a Fitbit. I've been using it for a couple of days. It tracks your fitness and sleep monitoring, information assist, and fully touch operation. So it's quite fun to use, and I look forward to sharing more information with you on that. So thank you for joining me today. Be safe on the wires and join the conversation at SafetyNet. It's S-A-V-E-T net. And let us know what else you want to learn about and hear about, and have a fantastic week ahead. Thank you.
Unbranded on CliffCentral.com.